It is Monday, June the 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Erdogan re-elected in Turkey.
They still like Erdogan. You know, after all these years of him in power, he is still their man. He still remains Turkey's most popular politician.
Mini summit on migration and the EU.
European countries came together, heads of government, and these are particularly the countries that are most affected by the migration influx.
U.S. continuing to grapple with immigration issues, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was proclaimed the winner early today of a landmark election. Muharrem İnce, the secular-leaning opposition candidate, was about 22 percentage points behind Erdogan, who declared victory for the People's Alliance, an electoral coalition between his ruling Justice Development Party and the small Nationalist Movement Party, saying that they had a parliamentary majority in the 600-member assembly. Reuters Emily Wither is in Istanbul.
As the results have been coming in here through the night, you can hear people celebrating on the streets, people honking their car horns, and even the occasional firework. But the main opposition here, the Republican People's Party, the CHP, say it's still too early to concede defeat.
Pazar günü hasta olmayın.
In the days running up to this vote, former school teacher Muharrem İnce drew hundreds of thousands out onto the streets in final rallies. Video clips are doing the rounds here as well on social media, showing opposition supporters carrying bags of ballot papers that they claim haven't been counted. Up to 500,000 monitors from opposition parties and NGOs were deployed to detect possible electoral fraud, saying there were some concerns about the fairness of these elections. Under the new constitution that comes into effect now after this vote, the president will hold considerable power. And critics say that these enhanced powers simply put too much into the hands of one person, and that Turkey lacks the checks and balances of other executive presidencies, such as the US. Erdogan argues that these new powers that he fought for last year in a referendum will put him in a stronger position to tackle the country's economy and crush Kurdish rebels in the south of the country and in neighboring Iraq and Syria.
That is Reuters' Emily Wither in Istanbul. For some perspective on Turkey's election, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Aaron Stein. He is a resident senior fellow of the Rafik Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council.
What makes this election interesting is that it was two parts. It was for parliament and it was for the president. And that the president, Erdogan, is now totaling about 52% of the votes. And so that's a clear victory that means that he won't have to go to a second round runoff. And at the parliament, his coalition, which is included with the far-right nationalists, also did well. And defying all expectations, and what I would say is the story of this election, is that his coalition partner, the MHP, the far-right nationalist, got 11% of the vote, where they had been polling around 5% before the polls opened.
What does this tell you about the Turkish voter?
They still like Erdogan. You know, after all these years of him in power, he is still their man. He still remains Turkey's most popular politician. I think what has everybody, including me, scratching their heads is how this far-right party, the MHP, did so well. They had fractured in two about a year ago. They didn't even campaign, and yet they were managed to pull in around 11% of the vote. And that really propelled Erdogan's party to victory, to where he has now complete control over the government.
Do you suspect voter fraud?
I mean, it's always hard to say. I mean, and I hate to make allegations that are unfounded. Certainly, I think what I would say is that there was concern, particularly amongst the opposition, about that number, about that 11% number, and how did it get high. But I would say, you know, the opposition was out there. They were monitoring ballot boxes. They were monitoring polls. And it seems to be a black swan election where nobody saw this coming, and the far-right party completely overperformed. And some of the opposition parties underperform.
Aaron, how is he going to use his new executive powers?
You know, it'll be basically a continuation of the status quo. He has been ruling under state of emergency since the failed coup, and it's said that they will lift the state of emergency after this election. But what this election does is it's the first election for Turkey's executive presidency, so which means power is officially consolidated in the office of the presidency. The prime minister is eliminated. In parliament now, because it's controlled by his party, the very few elements that they could check his power, they'll now act as a rubber stamp. So this is all Erdogan all the time, and we're now living in Erdogan's universe for at least the next 5 years.
Well, I was going to ask you then, does this spell the end of Kemal Atatürk's vision of a secular Turkey?
I mean, I think what the election did show you is that a lot of people don't like him, and so it's really hard to overcome these vast cultural schisms in Turkey. I mean, they're staring down some potential problems, at least on the economy. And, you know, people forget there'll be municipal elections in March 2019, and he'll want to control Istanbul and Ankara. You know, so we're going to head into another election cycle pretty quickly here. And he's going to be presiding over a troubled economy. So we're going to have to see how he governs and how he takes this mandate and moves forward. He's shown that he wants to be far-right nationalist. I'm not sure that that's a complete undoing of Atatürk's vision, but it's certainly Erdogan's republic now.
What does this mean for the Middle East, Europe, and the U.S.?
I would say it's the worst outcome for the U.S. and Europe, because the far-right party's coalition party is virulently anti-Kurdish, and so you're going to have a more hawkish and inward-looking AKP. If you're more nationalist, you're less amenable to compromise. For the Middle East, I mean, I just think we should expect continuation of the status quo. You know, Turkish positions in Syria, Turkish combat operations in Iraq, and in troubles with a lot of the Gulf countries, with the exception of Qatar.
Will he renew his call to extradite the Fethullah Gulen in the U.S.?
I assume so. You know, he wants him to come home. He wants him to face trial, and this is likely to continue to be a sore spot in U.S.-Turkish relations.
Fethullah Gulen, you might remember, is accused by Erdogan of orchestrating that 2016 failed coup. We just were hearing from Aaron Stein, a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump's decision to reverse a policy of separating immigrant families coming across the U.S. southern border came in the wake of a political firestorm in recent days. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the political fallout from the president's reversal.
President Trump center stage at a political rally in Minnesota, vowing to make immigration a central issue in this year's congressional election campaign.
If you want to create a humane, lawful system of immigration, then you need to retire the Democrats and elect Republicans to finally secure our borders.
Just hours earlier, the president reversed his controversial policy of separating children from their parents.
So we're going to have strong, very strong borders, but we're going to keep the families together.
Trump backed away from the separation policy after an outcry around the country that included protests, especially after the release of audio of children crying out for their parents. The outrage crossed party lines and included Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings.
We should be able to agree that we will not keep kids in child internment camps indefinitely and hidden away from public view. What country is that? This is the United States of America.
advocates of a tough border policy, like Art Arthur, sided with the president.
That large influx of individuals would suggest that we are starting to, you know, creep back up the numbers that we saw during the Obama administration, and the Trump administration needed to take action to respond. And this is an appropriate response.
But many religious leaders were critical, including Catholic Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
To use the means of separating a child from his or her mother just is completely unacceptable for us as Americans.
The immediate political fallout could hurt the president, says analyst Larry Sabato.
It's a public relations disaster area for the Trump administration, and just about everybody but Donald Trump and his very strongly anti-immigration aides seem to realize that.
But Sabato also says the president's tough stance is aimed at shoring up his political base ahead of the November elections.
Of course, they're focusing on their base. They're trying to make sure that they're going to show up and vote. It could make some difference in close midterm elections.
Trump's poll numbers have improved of late, especially in the wake of the summit with North Korea. But the surveys were taken before the firestorm over separating families at the border. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And as we've been reporting many times, immigration is a big issue among European nations. The leaders of 16 countries survived a frank talk at the emergency meeting on immigration and emerged with a veneer of somewhat of a common purpose on Sunday. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the meeting produced, in her words, a lot of goodwill to resolve differences over migrants. Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron held out little hope, they said, would be available to all nations that they would come together and come up with some sort of single immigration plan. Italy's new government remains opposed to an influx of migrants. So for some perspective on the European Migrant Summit, VOA's Lori London speaks with Paris-based journalist Catherine Field.
This Venice summit was originally meant to bring together some of 8 European Union countries. In the end, it was 16 European countries came together, heads of government, and these were particularly the countries that are most affected by the migration influx. So in particular, what we were looking at was Italy has been making the running on this. Italy has been saying for probably the last couple of weeks in really very stark terms that Europe has to help Italy out. Italy has got waves and waves of migrant boats arriving on its shores, and that Europe is not doing enough. And they say they're not doing enough because of these rules whereby a migrant has to apply for asylum in the country in which they land. Now, Italy says, this isn't enough. You're just putting all the emphasis on us. So there's a lot of backward and forward and a lot of antagonism, I really, you could say, between France and Italy ahead of this meeting, because France was saying, well, Italy needs to do more. Italy was saying, you don't understand. That was the reason for the meeting. Essentially, they have come up with no new plan, but they've put new ideas out there, which will be discussed later in the week.
Was the tension just before the meeting, or was the meeting itself tense?
Before the meeting, it was very tense. It's been tense, really, for about a week, ever since this new Italian government has started turning back ships which are carrying migrants. So think back last week, we had the case of the Aquarius, which had 630 migrants on board. The Italians said could not dock there, and it had to sail on to Spain. At the moment, we have a ship with 234 migrants adrift in the Mediterranean. Italy said that they can't dock there. Malta said. So you've already got this antagonism even before they got to the meeting. And it really was the Italians who came to this meeting saying, we are only going to talk if you look at our problem.
Do you think there's any validity to their complaints, or is it just the direction of the government that it's a very hardline stance when it comes to immigration?
50-50. Italy does have a lot of migrants landing on its shores. Admittedly, it's not as many as there were 3 years ago, but they've had some 18,000 come this year already. So they do have a problem with what to do with these migrants. How do you process that many migrants? How do you process their claims for asylum? how do you actually have that many people put through the system to decide whether they're actually entitled to asylum or if they need to be put on a plane back just because they're economic migrants. So you do have that problem for Italy. But at the same time, you do have a far more antagonistic tone to this debate, which we haven't seen before. The numbers of migrants are lowest, but you have this antagonism and you have these governments that are saying enough is enough. The European Union has to do more.
Was there any progress that came out of this mini-summit?
The progress that's been made, really, is the one thing that President Macron of France has said is that if EU countries do not accept migrants, then they should have either their funding from the European Union cancelled or cut back in some way, or they need to actually pay some money into the pot to help those countries that are bringing in migrants. So that was one suggestion that really hasn't fallen on deaf ears. And a lot of the EU governments have been saying, okay, now that's quite a good plan. Another idea, really, is that you start talking about opening up camps, which would be run by the United Nations and possibly the IOM. Now, these camps could either be in Europe or they could be in North Africa, but these particular camps where people would be accepted, and that's where they would have their application process. So that is the key, if you like, the two key issues that's going to go to the next meeting of the European Union.
That is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field speaking with VOA's Laurie London. Saudi Arabia on Sunday lifted the ban on women driving. Heretofore, women had to be driven by male drivers. This woman is a native of Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, and used to drive when she lived in the U.S. state of California, where she attended college.
All I can think about, I can still do my own stuff. I don't have to ask for anyone to take me around, and that's a very important, you know, for us to drive. Okay, maybe a lot of us don't need to drive, but for me, I used to drive. I used to do my own stuff, so I'm not used to someone to drive me around.
Lifting the ban, ordered by last September by King Salman, is part of a sweeping reform there pushed by his powerful young son, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, in a bid to transform the economy, the world's top oil exporter, and open up its cloistered society. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say our sun has been shining for about the last 4.5 billion years. The sun is expected to have enough hydrogen fuel in its core to shine for about another 5 billion years. Along with producing solar energy, this nuclear fusion is creating helium. Once the sun runs out of hydrogen, it will start fusing the helium and begin another 5 billion year process that will eventually result in the sun's death. The helium fusion process will cause the sun to expand and transform itself into a red giant star. According to a new study, as the red giant expands, it will lose mass and expel gas and dust, which will form a massive glowing ring called a planetary nebula. The sun will be a white dwarf by then and will eventually die. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music. The Shy Lights are an American R&B soul quartet from the city of Chicago. The group's greatest fame came during the early 1970s They scored 11 top 10 R&B hits from 1969 to 1974. They also charted 21 songs in the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Chart and had chart hits in Australia, the UK, Ireland, and Canada, as well as in the US. Are You My Woman was one of the Shy Lights' most popular songs. The group was formed in the late 1950s and went through an evolution or two to become the Shy Lights in 1964. One of their super hits, Have You Seen Her, scored big in 1971.
I know I can't hide from a memory, though day after day I've tried. I keep saying she'll be back, but today, again, I've lied.
Oh, I see her face everywhere I go, on the street and even at the picture show. Have you seen her? Tell me, have you seen her? Oh, I hear her voice as the cold winds blow in the sweet music on my radio. Have you seen her? Tell me, have you seen her?
Lights were inducted into the Rhythm and Blues Foundation in 2000 and were inducted into the Vocal Group Hall of Fame in 2005. And in August 2013, they were honored with a spot in the R&B Music Hall of Fame. Likely their biggest hit, charting number one on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1972, was Oh Girl.
Trouble if you left me now, 'cause I don't know where to look for love. I just don't know how. Oh, girl, how I depend on you to give me love when I need it. Right on time, you would always be.
The Shy Lights are still out on the road, entertaining fans everywhere, and Marshall Thompson, the only original member of the group, still performing, standing stage center. You know, I just learned that one of our former colleagues, Craig Barksdale, he was an engineer here, was also an engineer on a number of the Shy Lights recordings. That's pretty wild. Huh? I never knew that. Well, super. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from the Shy Lights.
I can save myself a lot of useless tears. Girl, I gotta get away from here. Oh, girl, pain will double if you leave me now. Cause I don't know where to look for love. And I don't know how. Oh, yeah.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The governments of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway have called on all warring parties in Darfur to lay down their arms and work with international peacekeepers to achieve a permanent peace. In 2003, armed opposition in the Darfur region of Western Sudan began an insurrection against the government in Khartoum in protest against government policies that they claimed discriminated against non-Arabic populations. The government sent troops to fight the uprising and also armed militias, the Janjaweed, to fight the rebels. But the Janjaweed were more interested in brutalizing the civilian population, resulting in a humanitarian crisis that left hundreds of thousands dead and 2 million people displaced. In 2007, a combined African Union United Nations hybrid operation in Darfur, or UNAMID, was deployed in Darfur to stabilize the region. Several ceasefire agreements were signed, as well as two peace agreements in 2006 and 2011. However, two of the major opposition groups, Justice and Equality Movement Jibril Ibrahim and the Sudan Liberation Army Abdul Wahid, or SLA-AW, refused to sign the agreement. SLA-AW has consistently rejected participation in any peace agreement, refused to declare any unilateral cessation of hostilities, and is engaged in confrontations with government forces. Hostilities began anew in March, and the government increased its troops and intensified the fighting. Finally, in mid-June, Sudanese government forces and the Sudan Liberation Movement Abdel Wahid clashed in central Darfur state, again forcing thousands of civilians to flee their villages. On June 19th, the governments of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway issued a written statement condemning the fighting, as well as intertribal violence in the Jebel Mara region of Darfur. The civilian population continues to bear the brunt of this unnecessary violence, which has led to the burning down of villages, causing high numbers of civilian injury and death, and the displacement of nearly 9,000 people, said the statement. There can be no military solution to the conflict in Darfur, and the international community should consider imposing sanctions against those who continue to act as spoilers. The three governments call on all parties to the conflict to immediately cease all military engagement and hostilities, allow unfettered humanitarian access, and to meaningfully engage with the African Union High-Level Implementation Panel-led peace process in order to reach a permanent ceasefire. The United States continues to engage all parties to the conflict to exercise restraint, engage in dialogue for a negotiated solution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Washington.